Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly program of the economic analysis of our jobs, our prices, our debts, our incomes, all the economic dimensions of our lives. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and I currently teach at the New School University in New York City. I also write columns for a number of publications, but especially truthout.org. That is a remarkable independent source of news and analysis every day. Check them out at truthout.org. If this program provides you with analysis, documents, links, classes, interviews, things like that that you're interested in, please know that we maintain two websites where we post a great deal of this material and much other material like it. The first website is rdwolf.com, and the second one is democracyatwork.info. Both of those websites are available to you free of charge, 24/7. And not only do they contain all the archives of these programs, for example, going back all 3 years that we have been producing them, which you can find at these websites, but they also contain lectures, video interviews, entire classes, some running a complete semester, and so on. In addition, these two websites offer you two other things I'd like to bring to your attention briefly. First, both websites allow you to communicate directly with us, to send us your suggestions, your criticisms, your questions. We read every single one and use your ideas to shape this program. So please know that you can participate and that we welcome your participation. And we also select a few questions to answer on the air. Please do understand we get many more of these questions than we could possibly have the time to deal with, so we have to be selective. But no prejudice is involved in choosing questions. We mainly choose those that seem to interest the largest number of people. And finally, by means of both websites, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info, you can click on the icon to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. Let me turn then to our updates for today, our short ones with which we begin every program, before I introduce to you our guest for the interview section in the middle of the program. The first update has to do with the great state of Nebraska. I'm talking about Nebraska for two reasons. One, I had a very pleasant time in Omaha last week, where I was able to address a large audience of interested folks and meet with all kinds of people in the area that are interested in the work we do and the kinds of work you hear and see on this program. But the second reason I want to talk to you briefly about Nebraska is that it is very unusual in a way that I think will interest you. All electricity in the state of Nebraska is produced by public companies. There is no private production and distribution of electricity in Nebraska. That's right. Nebraska does for power something like what North Dakota does for banking. If you recall, I have talked on this program more than once about the Public Bank of North Dakota, a unique institution out of the 50 states. Well, Nebraska is unique in a different way. Long ago, it decided to produce electric power publicly. So I want to talk to you a little bit about it. Before I do, I'm going to read to you the statement of the Nebraska Power Association. Somewhere I got my N's confused. Because I think the description by the Nebraska Power Association of what public power is in their state tells you how a conservative state in many ways comes to embrace and celebrate the public production of power. Here's from their website. Nebraska has the distinction of being the only state in the U.S. where every single home and business receives electric service from publicly owned utilities, such as municipal utilities, electric cooperatives, or public power districts. Nebraska has 167 different community-owned utilities. Across the whole United States, over 2,000 publicly owned utilities serve more than 43 million people. Lower electric prices. Why does this matter? Publicly owned utilities exist to serve customers, period. There are no stockholders, and thus no profit motive. Our electric prices do not include a profit. That means Nebraska's utilities can focus exclusively on keeping electric rates low and customer service high. Our customers, not big investors in New York and Chicago, own Nebraska's utilities. You can see the difference every month in your electric bill. Our costs to generate and deliver electricity do not include a profit markup. As a result, electricity costs in Nebraska are well below the national average. This is how the Nebraska folks justify and celebrate their decision to exclude private capitalist enterprises from any role in their electric power generation. And they've been that way for many, many decades, and they're very committed to stay that way. And they believe that they are better off by excluding profit motive and capitalism from their industry. I think it's important for you to think about that. They're proud that their electric enterprises are publicly accountable because they're owned by the public. They claim that their rates are lower. I checked. In 2011, the latest year for which I could find statistics, Nebraska came in 11th out of 50 states, the 11th lowest rates. Of course, electric rates are shaped by many things: how big a customer base you have, from whom you buy your electric power, how do you generate it if you generate it yourself, and so on. But it is clear that Nebraska is near the bottom, much, much cheaper than most of the states in the Union, and they credit that to their public commitment. Interesting, and something I found to be worth commenting to you about. I also want to say a word about Earth Day this last week and the economics of it. And the one dimension that I wanted to talk about very briefly is this. Many times, those who have wanted to exploit a toxic technology, who wanted to ignore how a project they were making money off of fouled the air or fouled the water or fouled the earth to the detriment of generations to come, many of them have pushed their projects through by getting the support of people who feared that if they didn't let the project through, their jobs would be hurt or they wouldn't get a job. In other words, we have damaged the earth because we were afraid that if we didn't, somebody's jobs would be hurt or lost. Here's a suggestion from an economist. Separate the two issues. Let's make decisions about our technology and what we produce and how we produce and where we produce that are mindful of the natural consequences, that really are careful about our environment and preserving it for our health and our futures. If there's a problem with jobs, let's say to those people whose jobs might be threatened by being more earth-friendly, we will provide you with jobs that are new and different. Don't worry, you will not lose a job. You will stop doing this job, which is environmentally dangerous, and the government of this country will raise the money from all those who can pay in this country to provide you with a socially useful job that isn't damaging to the environment. If we keep those two things separate, we remove one of the basic barriers to being more earth-friendly, to celebrating the earth. So it isn't just a holiday one day in April, but it's something real. And the way you do that is take care to provide more and better jobs to the people whose work is made redundant because we have a collective commitment to the earth. I also wanted to bring to your attention, in case you missed it, a small economic update that nonetheless speaks loudly. Over the last week, the Supreme Court of the United States heard a lawsuit brought against the Coca-Cola company by a small producer of pomegranate juice. Here was the issue. Coca-Cola has been advertising a new drink. The new drink is called some combination of the words pomegranate juice and blueberry juice. And this small pomegranate company brought a lawsuit, pointing out that the two main ingredients of this new Coca-Cola drink were apple juice and grape juice, two of the cheapest juices available. And that when you chemically measured how much pomegranate juice and how much blueberry juice was in this new Coca-Cola product, the two together comprised one-half of 1% of the new Coca-Cola product, leading the pomegranate juice company to claim that this was false advertising, that a drink being represented as pomegranate and blueberry was actually apple and grape, and falsely claiming that it was something that was actually only one-half of 1% of what was in there. And some of the Supreme Court justices of the United States had some caustic comments to make to the Coca-Cola company. What's going on here is clear. An advertising effort is being made by Coca-Cola to win people to buy a juice under the imaginary idea they're buying pomegranate and blueberry juice when they're actually buying apple and grape juice, which you can't sell so cleverly. True, in small print, underneath the pomegranate and blueberry, it says five juices flavored. But the implication is clear. Advertising plays this role. Advertising in our economy is a way to palm off on the public things that are different from what they are made to seem. And what drives big companies to pay big bucks to advertisers to come up with these schemes and to put it all over the label and to put it all over the billboard and to pull it all over the TV, what drives this is profit. And when there's a conflict between a profitable scheme and what's dishonest or misrepresents something you're about to put in your body, you can see which way the big corporations go. It's for their profit, not for you. And that's because of the way this system works and what kind of behavior it encourages. I want to also talk about a small event in a small corner of the United States, but that has big reverberations. There is a sad town in the northwest of Massachusetts. It's called North Adams. It's sad because it was once a thriving industrial community built around the Sprague Electric Motor Company, which left back in the 1980s. And it has been a pretty broken down industrial city ever since, basically because it has factories that are empty, it has industrial capacity that is not being used. And it has suffered, as so many communities have. But over the last few weeks, it has suffered a new indignity. It was medically served by something called the North Adams Regional Hospital. And because of the poverty of the people in that area, because they were abandoned by the employer who once provided health insurance, most of the residents, or at least a large proportion of them in North Adams, need to have their medical bills covered by Medicare and Medicaid. And the problem is Medicare and Medicaid have very low rates of reimbursing hospitals and doctors for the care they cover, which means hospitals like North Adams Regional depends on low rates, and it can't make that work. And so over the last few weeks, it suddenly, with 3 days' notice, closed its doors, even its emergency medical service. 530 people lost their job. When you deal with the ramifications of a closed hospital, hundreds more will be losing their jobs because of the effects of all these people being out of work. If it were just North Adams, I probably wouldn't have told you this story, but it isn't. North Adams is not alone. About a third of U.S. hospital emergency rooms have been shuttered over the last 20 years. 18 hospitals in the United States shut their doors over the last year. And because it is poor communities that rely most on Medicaid and Medicare, where have the medical facilities been cut? For poor people and for middle and lower income people more than for everybody else. So in addition to this country becoming more of a country of haves versus have-nots in terms of wealth and income, they're also becoming have and have-nots in terms of basic medical care. People in North Adams have to drive quite a way to the nearby city of Pittsfield, Massachusetts, to get emergency care at this point, let alone all the other kinds of care. It is difficult. It is costly. It takes time away from the job, which is uppermost in these folks' minds. It is unfair, and it is something that ought to make every American with even a little decency say, wait a minute. We have unspeakable wealth among the top 1 or 2 or 3%, more than they know what to do with. I've reported on this program, $30 and $40 million apartments in New York City, as a matter of course. But we can't keep open a emergency facility for people in a car accident who have swallowed something inappropriate for them to have in their body, who have a medical emergency of one kind or another, in a city in neighboring Massachusetts. What kind of society works this way? What kind of society allows this to happen? What kind of society gives people 3 days' notice to plunge them into unemployment and the thousands of people in the community they serve to be told no medical care facility available for you? Okay, we're now at that time where I want to introduce you to my guest. So let me begin to John Halley to say welcome to joining me on Economic Update.
Thank you, Rick.
Let me introduce all of you to John before we begin our conversation. John Halley teaches music at Bard College in Annandale-on-Hudson. It's a part of upstate New York. He teaches there at the Conservatory of Music. Formerly, he was on the Faculty of Music at Yale University. His music appears on recordings by the Meridian Arts and Cygnus Ensembles, Ethel, New Millennium, and the Common Sense Composers Collective, of which he is a founding member. Previously, he was a jazz pianist, where he performed with, among others, Sonny Stitt, Eddie Henderson, and Tom Harrell. While living in New Haven, Connecticut, Halley served 2 terms as an alderman. In New Haven, the city council is called the Board of Aldermen, where he was the elected representative of the New Haven Green Party. John Halley's writings on politics, the arts, and culture have appeared in New Politics, Jacobin, Counterpunch, Truth Dig, and the New Haven Register, the main newspaper in that part of the country. His scholarly work on shared mental representations of music and language has been published in various professional journals. And finally, he recently released a CD of his politically themed works on the Innova label, and that CD is called Outrages and Interludes. Okay, here's the first question I want to put to John and have him tell us how he sees this. You're a professional musician. You're a college teacher. Tell me how you see the economic and political trends that we talk about on this program week after week. Tell us how you, as a professional musician, a person involved in the arts and culture, how does all of this impact you and how do you relate to it?
Well, in general, musicians, as has the rest of the 99%, have suffered through the economic crisis and managed as best they could. To some degree, musicians have been, or at least musicians at various levels, are insulated from the worst effects in that grant money and commissions for composers and, say, jobs with major orchestras tend to be subsidized by the 1%, who've made out like gangsters, as you've pointed out many times on this program. So the funds that have supported certain types of music have continued to be available, though at the same time there has been pressure on arts institutions and musical institutions to impose austerity in the same way as there's been austerity imposed on other segments of the workforce. So to take a recent example, the chorus of the Metropolitan Opera is now being required to accept a 16% cut in their pay. And these are working singers around New York who have made their living for many years through singing not solo roles in the Metropolitan Opera, but in their chorus. This is their livelihood. They are now being expected to accept a 16% cut in their pay. More recently, the Minnesota Orchestra was locked out for almost their entire season by their corporate board and required to accept rather draconian cuts in their pay as well. So there's this odd paradox, at least in one sector of the music business, the so-called classical music sector, where musicians, where the funds that are supporting the enterprise, namely the top 1%, have huge resources available to them, but they have not made those resources available to the working musicians that are serving in the capacity of performers and are expected to present this music to the public. So it's a rather peculiar paradox, at least in one sector of the musical economy, shall we say.
So what you're telling us is that even though the folks at the top who subsidize music, or at least classical music, even though they've made out like bandits and arguably have more money than they've ever had, they're caught up in their own ideology that it's time to impose austerity on the mass of people, and they're upset by what's paid to professional musicians and impose on austerity on them too. It's a remarkable kind of insight into the self-delusion of ideology.
Yeah, I think it's important not to credit the upper 1% with too great a degree of rationality. there are instances when they are captives of their own view of seeing the world, even when it's not to their, and they will impose this worldview even when it's not really to their advantage to do so. And maybe this is an instance of that.
Okay, let me move on. Let everybody understand that John has been a political activist for as long as I've known him, which is quite some years. And so I wanted to ask how the economic system that he has to make his living in and that he has to navigate just like the rest of us do, how could you explain to us how you became not only a musician, but also a politically active one in the critical way that has defined your life?
Well, there's a historical answer to that question, which is that even though at least over the last, say, 15 or 20 years, I've made my living to some extent, but also taught within the genre of what's called classical music, it's only within the last few generations in which there's been this assumption that that music should be the music of the music of the elite. If you go back to the, say, cultural front period of the 1930s and the 1940s, and well, even into the 1950s, there was an assumption that classical music should be looked at as, say, a royal palace or the grounds or the crown jewels, which is the possession of the elite that should be made available to the public. And it should be effectively liberated from the ownership class and made broadly available. And so that was the ideology that motivated an entire generation of, say, American composers, say, like Aaron Copland, Mark Blitzstein, the composer of The Cradle Will Rock. These were active members of left-wing political groups that were at the same time committed to maintaining high arts traditions. And I see myself as attempting, let's say, to resuscitate that wing of our profession, meaning not necessarily crudely politically engaged works, but works that are based on the assumption that that the working class, as Bill Haywood famously said, should be provided with the best. Nothing is too good for the working class, said Bill Haywood. And one provides them with the best, not only in housing and in medical care, one tries to provide them with the best artistic resources that are available to them. So that's how I justify this rather odd seeming contradiction between the elite music that I study in my classes and I try to promote among my students, but at the same time my politics, which are very much about repossessing the resources that have been channeled to an excessive degree and towards the upper income groups.
Yeah, I've always been struck myself that if you go and you look at the origins of what passes for elite classical music, many times the origins are, again, in the working class, which you're trying to bring that music back to. So, for example, if you go to Italy, even today, opera is something that happens in many communities, large and small. The Italian people have a commitment to opera. It is not understood as something for the elite to go to an expensive palace that an average working person couldn't afford. The way, for example, opera is mostly handled in the United States, in those few communities that even have a regular opera. And likewise, Mozart was fond of saying that he got many of his ideas of musical themes and melodies from folk music, from the popular songs of his time. In other words, the working class often generated the very kinds of beginning notions that were then rarefied or ramified or refined, fine, but that, in a sense, you're bringing it music, classical music, back to the very people from whom it first came.
Right. And I think it's important to recognize that at the times when there was maybe the most cross-fertilization between what we would call maybe crudely high and low culture art forms was the time in which there was the greatest acceptance of the division between the high and low arts. So, for example, there was no question in Aaron Copland Vine that there was a distinction between classical music and other kinds of music, which is not to say that there can't be very bad classical music and outstanding pop and jazz and other sources. But in fact, under the conditions in which one was able to make the distinction, I think there was the most cross-fertilization and there was the most kind of acceptance of the need for both kinds of music and both all forms of art to learn from each other.
Good. Let me move towards our mid-program break by posing to you an old and classic question I assume you've thought about. There is a kind of critic of cultural work, whether it's a painting or a musical composition or a poem, that believes that you have to keep whatever your political point of view is rigidly separate from your artistic creation, because if you don't, your political interests will somehow corrupt or destroy or undermine your creative, your artistic activity. What do you think about that argument, and how do you respond to it in terms of your own work?
It's a complicated question for me in that most of the musicians I know are entirely immersed in the world of music. That's all they think about 24 hours a day. And what motivates them is just the pure question of how can I produce the greatest piece of music? How can I assemble the notes? What's the most striking, purely musical idea that I can come up with that when a listener hears it, it's going to set his ear on edge and he's going to say, wow, that's amazing. Of course, there are other composers that have different kinds of motivations and where they think, I have an idea that's even broader or even more general, that's in some sense expressed through these notes, but it's a way of looking at the world, it's a way of looking at how we can relate to other people, how we can unify groups in the society that is served through musical means. And I would say on my best days, my music can embody that worldview, I hope. But I wouldn't say that that motivation should be necessarily prominent for any given musician. There are many paths to Rome, and that's certainly the case for musical composition or producing music of any sort.
Okay, folks, I'm going to take our mid-program break as we normally do. I'm talking with John Halle. I want to spell his name for you, H-A-L-L-E, a professional musician giving us a way of looking at the economic crises and trends of our time through the lens of someone engaged full-time in the world of art and culture. We will be back shortly after our break. Please stay with us. This is Richard Wolff and Economic Update. Welcome back, friends. This is Economic Update. I'm Richard Wolff. As we head into the second half of today's program, we're talking with John Halle, a professional musician who teaches at Bard College Conservatory of Music. And we were talking about how a political commitment, a political agenda, can interact with musical composition and be part of what a musician is trying to do. I want to go back to an earlier topic and get a little more from you about how the current economic changes in the United States, whether it be the growing gap between rich and poor, whether it be the enormous number of people without work, how is this in a kind of daily life way affecting culture in general, cultural production, music in particular? How are musicians, for example, reacting? How is this affecting their life in an ongoing way?
Well, I think over the long to medium term, what I've noticed and members of my musical generation have noticed was that there was a relevant concept when we began our musical career, that there was a distinction to be made between commercial music and art music. And commercial music was music that one attempted to market, which had a high chance of maximizing the income that it would generate. And, of course, every musician wants to be popular, and every musician wants to achieve the widest possible audience for the music that they produce. But at the same time, there's an awareness that what is possible to compromise your musical ideas and that it's possible to compromise oneself in the pursuit of them. Now, in a generation where there were resources available to the arts and when there were, for example, academic positions that were available to musicians, one at least could convince oneself, whether it was always true in reality is another story, but one could at least believe that one could make, one didn't need to make as many compromises as is absolutely required, say, for musicians now, for whom, all of whom are expected now to sell, be able to sell their musical product, and that it's assumed, if it's legitimate, that it should be able to sustain itself and survive the Darwinian competition of the marketplace. Now, I'm not going to say that there are not really substantial benefits to looking through the world through that lens. You know, Marx himself was a big believer in the potential of capitalism and how capitalism generates tremendous entrepreneurial energies and makes people take really to go to the nth degree to achieve. But the other side of that is that the market is inherently limiting. in that there's an expectation now that that audiences, that the product that needs to be provided for audiences is of a particularly limited sort. And I find that that's definitely, there's a kind of musical monoculture that is based on commercial, market-oriented music that was has been imposed over the long term as opposed to what was available, say, a couple of generations ago, where there was, I think, a greater range of at least musical aspiration. Maybe not necessarily musical achievement, but musical aspiration.
So again, we're coming to the point you made earlier, that even though we have concentrated enormous wealth in a relatively tiny part of our population, more than enough for that tiny elite, wealthy elite, the people who run the big enterprises of this society or own them, even though we have concentrated unspeakable wealth in their hands, they have not, as have previous generations of such wealthy people, seen that their wealth needs to be expressed in a kind of sponsorship or patronization of the arts, so that it is less, not more, possible for artists to do what they want as an artistic act without worrying about the market because some rich patron sustains them. In a sense, then, we have all of the negatives of a concentration of wealth without even the small offsets of a flourishing of the arts, because that's not what these people seem to want to do with their accumulated wealth. Am I reading you right?
I can't say that I've studied this matter, that I've done the kind of statistical work that's necessary to actually determine.
Yeah.
But my impression is that among, say, elite classes, there is a belief now that they've, as we were saying before, accepted a market fundamentalist view of artistic production, so that what can survive the rigors of the marketplace is that which has inherent value. And that's a very untraditional view of the elite classes, of the aristocratic classes, who in the past made the case for their acquisition of wealth and their possession of wealth and the leisure and the resources that it provided based on the curatorial function that they provided in societies. So maybe they had a lot of money, but the way that they justified their wealth was that they were able to support and they had the judgment and the ability to make to support artistic resource, the sustenance of artistic culture. Now, you know, you see people at the very top. I'll give you an example. Paul Allen, one of the heirs to the Microsoft Foundation. Right? He does not give any of his money to the Seattle Symphony Orchestra. He gave a substantial donation, in fact, some very large fraction of the funds that were necessary to construct the Experience Music Project, which is a rock museum that was established in the city of Seattle. Now, I don't have any objection to that, but the fact that this is music that has succeeded tremendously well through the marketplace, it's music that generated enormous revenues for those that were producing it, at least at the time. That's an important point. It's not music that's that requires sustaining by an elite class. But on the other hand, Allen himself believes that its commercial potential is itself a validation of its quality. And I believe that the ideology of the elite classes now has accepted that view of the world, where their curatorial function is no longer as necessary as it was in the past.
You know, there's an article of the viewpoint of historians that when the people who run a society believe the ideology they purvey to the masses to stay in power, that their days of running that society are now numbered, that they have bought and swallowed their own Kool-Aid rather than understanding the difference between the perspective of running a society and the nonsense you try to foist on other people to get them to accept your role as running the society. Let me go back, as we go back and forth, to ask you again, as a modern musician, how do you understand the differences between pop music, jazz music, opera music, classical symphony music? Are these different degrees of sophistication? Are they higher and lower forms of art? Are they different forms of art? How do you understand the world of culture as you make your life in it?
Right. I have a fairly technical, precise way of understanding this, which is derived from my former professor, Richard Taruskin from UC Berkeley, whose six-volume Oxford History of Western Music is based on the following premise, which is that in about the 19th century, there was an, ninth century, there was an invention. It was the invention of musical notation. Western musical culture is unique in having access to musical notation, which is a system which allows the expression of, let's say, a, not an unlimited range of musical ideas, but a functionally fairly wide range of
before the
of
ninth
ideas.
Century, just
musical
my ignorance,
didn't,
people didn't have a way of writing down.
Absolutely not. And the over, I mean, and the overwhelming majority of musical cultures in the world are, the music is transmitted orally, just in the same way as the overwhelming majority of languages, in fact, in the world do not exist in written form.
Right.
Right? Notation had to be invented. And so it was invented, say, sometime in the medieval period, and then it continued throughout the common practice period. And then it's reasonable to at least promote the notion, as Taruskin does, is that it has an end. And that the overwhelming majority of music that people listen to now and appreciate is now no longer notated.
Right.
Okay? It's music that does not exist on the page. And so, for example, most music from the popular music tradition doesn't exist on the page. And I remember as a child, I thought it was, as a learning classical piano, I always was trying to get, where can one get the scores for this new Beatles song that I'm learning? I just assumed that all music was written down. But in fact, that was an extremely biased notion. Most music is not. And most music is transmitted and learned orally through ear. And in fact, that's a more traditional way of promoting, of transmitting music. But the Western art music tradition is defined entirely based on the medium of notation. Now, it's important to be clear, that's not evaluative. There can be terrible music that exists in notation. There can be very fine music that exists in notation. There can be wonderful music that's transmitted orally and is improvised or just exists in the player's head. That's not, it's, it, it is in no way evaluative of the quality. It's just a characteristic. However, I would make the further claim that there are particular special virtues that are attached to this tradition that justifies the resources that are required to maintaining it. And the resources, of course, are substantial. You have to teach kids how to learn to read music. And as everybody who has a kid knows, this skill is not accomplished without tears.
Right.
It's a hard thing to learn. You have to maintain the resources of a library for symphony orchestras. You have to have this entire cadre of musicians trained, go through a very rigorous program of training in order to sustain it. You either have that or it dies. And it's not entirely possible that within, say, my child's lifetime, that he will, I think, see this culture die if it's not sustained. Not out of the question. That's my opinion.
And how might that affect the different genres of music? Jazz, pop, classical. Will this end of written music impact the kinds of music we will have?
Well, that's an interesting question because, as I was saying before, often what I found to be the most interesting periods within these other genres were the periods when there was a distinction, when there was a high culture in which they, which was seen as being the other, which they were attempting to respond to. So, for example, in the 1940s, you had the Woody Herman Orchestra commissioning Igor Stravinsky to write the Ebony Concerto, a piece that I love. Or you have Bela Bartok writing a piece for Benny Goodman, one of the great pieces of chamber music, Contrasts. You have Stefan Volpe teaching Charlie Parker, or it is claimed Charlie Parker wanting to go to see Stefan Volpe to learn about modern techniques and composition. So traditionally, there's been a very interesting kind of cross-fertilization between high and low cultures. And I would say the cross-fertilization has been most fruitful at the times when we were most willing to make this distinction. Whereas now, one could at least make the argument that maybe the cross-fertilization is less fruitful because there isn't the same kind of distinction that is able to be drawn between the genres.
Okay, you've given us your views on art, politics, economics, and what's happening in the world of music. If there are folks interested in listening to the kind of music a person like you produces, tell us where they might go to listen to it.
Well, there are all sorts of places, dispersed small groups around the country, so-called new music groups. Often, by default, they end up at universities because that's where the universities provide the resources for these. My own group, the Common Sense Composers Collective, is a bi-coastal group, but the composers of this collective are in San Francisco, are in New York City, are in Chicago, there's one in Canada. Our website has information about what we're doing.
Tell us the website so listeners...
commonsensecomposers.org is our website.
Good.
You will find out who we are in that through them. My school, the Bard Conservatory of Music, has all sorts of interesting groups that are attached with it. One, the student group Contemporaneous, recently broke out of the academic ghetto and is having an active concert career in New York City. My former students are from when I taught at Yale are everywhere doing wonderful things. One of them, in fact, is recently had a big hit musical called The Book of Mormon.
Okay.
It's Bob Lopez is my former student from Yale. There's a huge amount of all different music that's out there, which mixes and matches these kinds of genres. So I would say the exciting thing about the period in which we are listening, or we are living through now, is that often you would be hard pressed to tell just on a minute's exposure whether a piece that's deriving from the tradition that I'm describing, a classical art music tradition, is in fact within that tradition. It might not have any violins in it at all. It might not have pianos. It might be a piece for 27 guitars. It might be a piece for 8 bassoons. A wonderful piece that I recently heard by the composer Michael Gordon was a piece for 8 bassoons. So that's the remarkable, and I would say the positive spin on the fact that the boundaries have very much broken down between these genres, or at least what we perceive as being distinct genres.
Thank you very much, John, and I hope my audience shares with me the notion that it's important to understand how this crisis is affecting the art world and vice versa, what's going on in the world of cultural production, because it's part of what shapes the life everybody leads. Thanks again, John. I really appreciate it. Okay, in the time that remains for us, I'm going to respond to 2 questions that came in. The first has to do with asking me to evaluate something called the B Corporation. B as in the letter B, as in boy. The B Corporation is a movement in the United States and indeed in other countries that has been legally enshrined by the acts of a great many of the states of the United States, not all, but a good number. And it establishes another kind of corporation that is of interest, I think, to those of you that listen to this program. A B Corporation is a corporation that legally is empowered and allowed to do something other than make money for whoever owns and operates the corporation. Normally, corporations exist to make money, the famous bottom line. And indeed, corporations can be sued by their shareholders, for example, if the shareholders believe that they are not doing all in their power to make money, since that's what a corporation is organized for, and that's what most corporations do. The B Corporation was set up as a special kind of corporation which would not be limited to profit-making activities. In other words, a B Corporation is a corporation that says, in addition to making money, we are also engaged in doing something good for the environment or being socially responsible. There's a lot of other objectives that it can legally pursue alongside making money. So this is a kind of corporation organized by people who are dissatisfied with simply a company devoted to making money. They believe that is too narrow, and for society as a whole, too limited a focus or a goal for an enterprise to have. And they want enterprises to be legally empowered and indeed encouraged to pursue multiple different goals, particularly socially beneficial ones. So what do I think about this? Well, here's what I like about this movement. It is an honest recognition that companies devoted to making money, first and foremost, will often find themselves in the position of sacrificing all kinds of other benefits society could get from an enterprise, because those have to be sacrificed if you're going to do what a regular corporation is supposed to do, which is maximize the return, maximize the profits, earn money for those that are invested in it. So it's a recognition that what can be privately profitable for an enterprise can be socially destructive. That's a point that critics of capitalism have made for a long time. On the other hand, I must say in all honesty that this is very much of a baby step, because what it does is still leave the profit-maximizing goal as part of what drives the corporation. Therefore, it doesn't quite confront kind of what happens when maximizing profits contradicts preserving the environment. How is this corporation going to make that decision when it has both goals? It can't meet both of them at the same time. Uh-oh, something's going to have to give. And given what most corporations do, it's not a bad guess that a good bit of the time what's going to be sacrificed are the larger goals, just the way other corporations do. And I would further say that this is a proposal that leaves completely untouched the internal organization of the enterprise. In other words, we're just talking about a B Corporation as having different goals, but not a different method of running the operation. So the mass of people will still, in a B Corporation, be excluded from participation. A B Corporation is just as undemocratic as a regular corporation, in the sense that a tiny group of people at the top, major shareholders, and the board of directors are now supposed to be making decisions with more than one goal, with several goals, but the mass of people, the workers who make whatever the company produces, are still excluded from participation. For me, that means we will still have decisions made for a minority, by a minority. It's an undemocratic way of dealing with organizations, and to celebrate the B Corporation means to ignore this whole question, and since I think that's the most burning question of our times, economically and politically, I see the B Corporation as a very modest accommodation to a glaring flaw in private capitalism, but not much more than that. Finally, in the time that remains, I wanted to talk briefly about a point brought up by a listener in response to my interview of Nomi Prince in the recent past. As you know, she was here to talk about her new book, Bankers and Presidents, and the Power and Influence of Finance in Modern American Capitalism. And my listener was critical and said, "Why did you say nothing about the Wall Street sales tax?" So I wanted to respond by saying something about it. This is an idea that's been around for a long time. In fact, it is often referred to with the name of my teacher at Yale University, James Tobin, who won a Nobel Prize in economics. This is often referred to as a Tobin tax. And here's what it is, and here's what the arguments for it and against it are, and you'll see that they're a little bit similar to what I just said about the B Corporation. The Tobin tax, or the Wall Street sales tax, says roughly the following. We pay sales taxes when we buy a shirt, when we buy a radio, when we buy all kinds of things. And that is a tax that falls on all of us. Why isn't there a comparable sales tax on buying and selling shares of stock, on buying and selling bonds? There's an enormous market. Trillions of dollars of these things are bought and sold. The bulk of these purchases and sales are done by the financial giant corporations who handle all of that, the big banks, the big stock brokerages, and so on. Why aren't they paying a tax? Particularly because finance has become much more important, particularly because these institutions have become much richer. This is a tax that should have been levied long ago and can be afforded by those who would have to pay. When you put all that together, there's an argument that there ought to be such a tax. Even if it were a tiny percentage, it would raise an enormous amount of money, and that would provide governments with the ability, for example, to keep open hospitals like the North Adams Regional that we spoke about earlier. It's something that should have been done, it could be done, and my not discussing it is not in any way to be taken as not seeing the value of doing it. But I still have to say, in conclusion, taxing the rich, in this case, the finance, in order to do some good, is really coming at the problem the wrong way. Why are there a few institutions with so much wealth? How did they get to be in a position to have so much influence over our politics and our culture? Why is it so undemocratic since such a tiny number of people have such a disproportionate wealth? Why have we even allowed it? We should reorganize the economy so there aren't rich and poor, so that we don't have a tiny minority with outsized power over the rest of us. Rather than taxing a little of that after they've gotten most of it, let's change it from the beginning. Let's not have an unequal society so we don't have to have endless disputes amongst us on how to fix it to make it a little less unequal than it has already become. That's where a more profound criticism has its role to play. We've come to the end of our time. Thank you very much. This is Richard Wolff. Want to thank again our guest, John Halley, Economic Update, and I look forward to speaking with you again next week.